Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, a long-awaited apology from the City of Philadelphia for 20 years of unethical medical experiments performed on mostly black men at Holmesburg Prison. We'll hear from the daughter of a former prisoner whose life was turned upside down by her father's experience. She'll be joined by the author of Acres of Skin, a book about the experiments performed by Penn researcher Albert Kligman. And later, a little planning could lead to a lot more zen in your life and help you find time for the things and the people that matter most. We'll talk with Philadelphia-based author and productivity expert Laura Vanderkam about her new book, Tranquility by Tuesday. But we begin with another roadblock for Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney in his latest attempt at curbing gun violence in the city. A federal judge ruled last week that the mayor's executive order banning guns from city parks and recreation centers cannot go into effect. The reason? A state law that bans local governments from passing gun measures that are stricter than the state's own gun laws. All this comes just weeks after Tiffany Fletcher, an employee at the city's Mill Creek Rec Center, was killed by a stray bullet from a nearby gun battle. A 14-year-old has been charged with her murder. To date this year, more than 1,800 people have been shot in Philadelphia. Nearly 400 have died of their wounds, and overall homicides stand at 416 for the year thus far. So, what legal remedies does the city have to reduce gun violence, and can state law be changed to allow cities and counties to tailor gun safety laws to their own needs? Joining us with more is Susan Lee Bell, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University. She is a nationally recognized expert on the Second Amendment and studies how gun rights and regulations affect democratic citizenship. Professor Lee Bell, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
So this Pennsylvania state law is a bit of a head-scratcher. I'm wondering why it is that the law prohibits cities and counties from passing gun laws that address their own unique circumstances.
Well, first of all, these types of preemption laws are relatively new, although they're very popular across the United States. About 40 other states have laws similar to Pennsylvania. Preemption means that the law at the higher level of government is used to overrule the authority at the lower level, and here it means that Pennsylvania state law preempts anything that the city of Philadelphia would like to do that goes beyond what the state already has in place. And that means that rural, suburban, and dense urban areas, can't tailor to local conditions. Why is the state law there? Is because there was a political process on the part mostly of the NRA to pass such laws at the state level to, in their eyes, protect the gun rights of individuals and prevent cities, dense cities like Philadelphia, from prescribing those rights.
Well, and it's not the first time that the city has attempted to challenge the state law on gun safety. I mean, we've seen this before. I guess the question is, if Mayor Kenney already knew that his executive order was likely going to bump up against state law and be struck down, why even bother creating the order?
Well, I think that what Kenney was trying to do was call attention to what is not just a Philadelphia problem, but what is a national problem, which is that mayors of cities like Philadelphia are looking for as many tools as possible to curb gun violence. As you said in the opening, Philadelphia has remarkably high numbers, and those numbers are even higher if we recognize that they're worse than LA and New York, and those are cities that are much larger than Philadelphia. So the mayor is looking for as many tools as possible, and one of them that he wants is restricting, for example, in park areas. And what he's trying to do with this measure is to emphasize the city as a property owner, not as the holder of police powers. And that's the difference between this measure and the earlier measures. And I should say that this goes back to the Nutter administration. There's been multiple attempts by the city to find ways to carve out different laws for a place that is very different from many other places in Pennsylvania, and they have sometimes been successful, for example, on ghost guns.
And my understanding is that the city of Philadelphia did sue the state in 2020 with the aim of being able to create its own gun laws. Do you know what the status of that lawsuit is or whatever came of that?
It is still active in Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And that lawsuit is fascinating because what the city was saying was that the state of Pennsylvania had created what they called a state-created danger. And they said that by stopping the city from dealing with gun violence, the state was taking away constitutional right to, quote, enjoy and defend life and liberty, which is promised by the Pennsylvania Constitution, and also the ability to maintain order and preserve the safety and welfare of all citizens. So that's still working its way through, but the idea there is, what is Philadelphia to do? They have a very, very serious issue with gun violence, again, as the stats that you laid out and the very sad story of Tiffany Fletcher and many other people like her. One thing I would say about the way we frame what Mayor Kinney is doing is that it is, in fact, very new to have these kinds of restrictions on cities. So if we look back in time at the 18th century, we see that cities like Philadelphia and Boston and New York were regulating firearms and the storage of gunpowder, et cetera. So it's a very longstanding practice for cities to do something different than the country or they didn't have suburbia in the 18th century, but I know the equivalent of that now. So I think we have to sort of place it in that longer context as well, that what Kinney is asking for is something that used to be available, but something that was taken away in a political process. So for those people who are thinking of Kinney's action as political, he is engaged in a political action, yes, but also in this wider context of these laws having been changed by a group that represents a minority of American beliefs on guns.
And speaking of wider contexts, as you well know, last summer the Supreme Court struck down a New York state law that required people who wanted to carry a concealed weapon to show probable cause. And in the majority opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote that the Second Amendment, and I'm quoting here, protects an individual's right to carry a handgun for self-defense outside the home. And I'm wondering, as an expert in the Second Amendment, do you agree with that interpretation?
No. The Supreme Court for over 200 years read the full Second Amendment, which includes a passage on the militia. In 2008, Justice Scalia reread that and said that the first part of it didn't count. Now, he didn't have reasons for why it didn't count. He just said that it meant something different than we had thought for 200 years. And that was a radical shift in American law, and many people thought that that was, in fact, not an appropriate reading. And if you look back at the Federal Convention in Philadelphia, they were talking about exemptions for people with religious objections to war when they were discussing the Second Amendment. So there's a good argument to be made that it wasn't intended to be about individuals, and it certainly is not in the context of the rules that were in place in the 18th and 19th century. The Duke Firearms Project has an accessible free public database, and you can look at all of those laws and see just how many of them limited guns. So I would say that both Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia are not really reading the Second Amendment in its historical manner. They're reading it in a political manner, which is, in fact, the intent of that decision.
Yeah. And in the case of Philadelphia, again, it was the Gun Owners of America who challenged Mayor Kenney's executive order most recently. Who are they? And can you talk about, you know, what stake they would have in Philly playgrounds, especially at a time when there have been so many shootings, I mean, several hundred over the last few years, just at Philly rec centers?
Yeah, I mean, the Gun Owners of America are a not-for-profit. They have a base in Philadelphia, in the Commonwealth, in York, I believe it is where the Pennsylvania director is located. And they're a gun rights group that feels that the NRA isn't strict enough, and they want what they call a no-compromise gun policy. And they are working not just in the state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but across the nation to turn over laws or executive actions, as Kenny put forward. They're quite well funded, and they are working to, you know, create pushback. They're also asking that there be retaliation. So, for example, it wasn't enough that they won this recent overturning of Kinney's order. They want him to be punished, and that is a trend across in some states, in some more extreme states, to punish legislators or executives who have put forward these kind of policies, and that would have a silencing effect that could be quite devastating for those who are working towards gun safety laws.
So when you say punished, do you mean in terms of, you know, not reelected, or what does that mean?
No, it wouldn't just be not reelected. They ask for different things. In some cases, they want the legal fees of the Gun Rights of America or whomever is private citizens who are pushing the cases. They want there to be penalties for governments or people who put these things forward. So that would obviously create a disincentive if you wanted to put forward something that you thought was merely symbolic or might get overturned by a court.
So all this gets to the million-dollar question, which is what recourse, if any, does a city like Philadelphia have to curb gun violence, given what the state law says, the fact that the lawsuit has been languishing for 2 years, people are getting shot literally every day, and it appears that the mayor's hands are tied.
I think that because the Dobbs abortion decision came down at the same time as the New York State gun decision, we have not fully understood how radical that decision was, the Bruin case. New York State's law was 100 years old, and I think people missed that it was going to mean that states and localities had even less power than they'd have before. What can be done? Well, number one, you would change the state legislature. Colorado and Virginia have both overturned their gun preemption laws, and that is by changing the makeup of their state legislatures. So generally, Democrats have favored removing these kinds of preemption rules. That is difficult in the Commonwealth, but not impossible. And it would be interesting to see whether or not Democrats could explain preemption. Second thing would be to attack gerrymandering, even though we have made advances in the Commonwealth on gerrymandering. We are still, according to the Princeton Gerrymander Projects, a B state. And as the people of Philadelphia and other urban areas across the Commonwealth are have less voting power, that means it makes it harder to change the legislature. And I also think that there are other approaches that are being explored by the city, other kinds of prevention at the community level that try to get at these rates of crime violence.
Well, Professor Susan Lee Bell, we have to leave it there, but thank you so much for making time to help us understand this very complicated issue. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry to have to be here.
More Regional Roundup when we come right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. It was an acknowledgement 70 years in the making. Last week, the city of Philadelphia formally apologized for the unethical experiments performed on people incarcerated at Holmesburg Prison, mostly black men, between 1950 and 1970. The researcher behind the experiments was Dr. Albert Kligman, the Penn dermatologist and faculty member who developed Retin-A. Kligman exposed his subjects to everything from viruses to LSD to asbestos and even a component of Agent Orange. In 2000, several hundred former prisoners sued the city as well as Penn and Dr. Kligman, but the statute of limitations had expired. Joining us with more are two of the three people who requested that apology from the city. Adrienne Jones Alston is a prison reform activist and the daughter of the late Leotis Jones, who was one of the Holmesburg prison test subjects. Adrienne, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. Good morning.
And also joining us is Alan Hornblum, the author of Acres of Skin, which is about one of the men incarcerated at Holmesburg. He also wrote Sentenced to Science. Alan, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Thank you, and I appreciate your interest in this story. Mm.
So, Adrian, let me begin with you. Your father, as I mentioned, was one of Dr. Kligman's test subjects at Holmesburg back in the 60s. What kinds of experiments were done on your dad?
My father, I know one of the experiments was the dioxin, and he had participated in a few of the studies, and dioxin was one of the ones that stood out to him as having the most damages, you know, to his physical health.
And dioxin is a component of Agent Orange, correct?
Yes, it is.
And so, Adrian, what did you see as a result of that when your dad came home? What condition was he in after being subjected to those tests?
My father's whole demeanor changed. I'm talking about the mental part. He was our breadwinner. He was the father that kept us involved in community activities, cookouts, family events. When he returned home from prison, all that stopped. And I accidentally saw his back one day when I entered the bedroom, and he had his back turned, and I saw the scars, and it scared me. And I ran to my mother crying because I was afraid because it was so ugly. I'll never forget it.
Mm. Alan, your 1998 book, Acres of Skin, that we mentioned a moment ago, is about these experiments that were conducted on incarcerated people at Holmesburg. Where does that title come from?
Well, I get a lot of credit for that phrase, but it's not mine. It's Dr. Kligman's. He used it all the time. The first time I saw it was when I was doing research on this whole issue in the 1990s, and I came across an article, I believe it was either in the Bulletin or the Philly Inquirer, where he was telling a reporter that he has acres of skin to work on. So he didn't see these individuals in Holmesburg when he first walked in there in 1951 as people. He didn't see them as prisoners. He viewed them as acres of skin in which he could do his experiments. He was a dermatologist. He was very bright. He was very crafty. He was shrewd, certainly entrepreneurial. And what he recognized were hundreds and hundreds of men who were locked up. They weren't going anywhere. They weren't particularly astute. They weren't smart. They didn't have degrees. They didn't have connections. They were just languishing in a prison on a cell block. And if he could get the green light from the warden, the superintendent of the system, he would have a field day. He did accomplish that. And for the next near quarter century, he did all sorts of experiments, running from the innocuous to the truly dangerous.
Yeah. Adrian, you've said that your father's injuries have affected the whole family, and his experience affected you in profound ways. I mean, really turned your life upside down. Can you share just a little of the fallout in your own life from what was done to your father?
Yes. My father's scars, like I just said, were very hideous. His demeanor changed, and that made him a different man. He became hostile and at times violent. And I was like 5 or 6 years old, and I had to witness that as a kid. You know, as a result of his mental state, he had became so unbearable in the household. My mother had to move to protect the family because my father was no longer able to function as a father he was, being our breadwinner and all. It was just too unbearable for her. So by us separating from my father, not only did the scars devastate me, but the separation dug even deeper. And I kind of went through an emotional withdrawal and was diagnosed with being emotionally disturbed, and probably well into my early teens.
Mm. Alan, these experiments went on for 2 decades, and not in some remote corner of the country, but in what was then the third largest city in the country. How was that able to happen?
Well, what it is, really, is a ringing indictment of the entire city. And in my last chapter of Acres of Skin, I really give everybody a kick in the ass, quite frankly. That includes the media, that includes journalists, but foremost, Kligman. he thought everybody was put on earth to be a test subject for him. Whatever he had curiosity about or was going to make money testing, he was willing to use people. He actually got started. The first people he used were children at Vineland and Woodbine. At that time, they were called the state colonies for the feeble-minded in Vineland and Woodbine. And he would travel from West Philly to South Jersey to experiment on children, 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old children. In many cases, he would rub all sorts of, substances into their scalp, take off fingernails, and just study them and to see if he could come up with a concoction that would cure whatever he gave them. And this went on for years throughout the late 1940s, and he was publishing articles on this. Then in 1951, he is invited to Holmesburg because they have a breakout of athlete's foot, and Kligman had developed a reputation for dealing with fungus. So he did go up there and take a look at the problem, but as he said then and everybody else, he saw acres of skin, which he could use for his own dermatological curiosity and interest. And that went on for a quarter century. The University of Pennsylvania, with all of these elite PhDs and MDs and foremost talents in all sorts of areas, nobody blew the whistle on it. Even though people knew there was something suspicious about it or untoward about it, nobody went to the administration and said, you know, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. It's really unethical. And it's just a very sad commentary. As you said, the third largest city in the nation is willing to put up with this. The Tuskegee study that ran for 40 years, where black men, unsophisticated, impoverished, were used in a decades-long experiment, was in the backwoods of Macon County, Alabama. But what we have here in Holmesburg and D.C., Detention Center and the House of Correction, all three prisons, was in what was, you know, considered early in the city's history, the Athens of America, and later the city likes to prop up itself as the city of brotherly love, but they were using incarcerated people day after day, year after year, and no one seemed to be bothered by it. And when I walked into the prison system and saw it for myself the first time in 1971, I was truly shocked by it, because there were scores and scores of inmates walking through the corridors and on the cell blocks with all sorts of adhesive tape and medical dressing on. And I'm thinking to myself, is this place that dangerous? It looks like they're constantly having knife fights and riots in the prison yard. But the next day I asked the guard on his cell block, what's the story with all these wounded men? And he just chuckled and said, oh, that's nothing. That's just the perfume experiments for the University of Pennsylvania. Mm. Everybody bought into it, not only the inmates, who weren't particularly sophisticated and were desperate for the money that they made, but the guards and the social workers. And it really goes to show you that people can grow accepting of really dangerous things in the community once they walk into it and are told by high officials it's okay, we're working with a prestigious university. Right. Everybody thought it was okay, and the whole atmosphere was particularly stunning. And it's a lesson to me and everybody else, I think, that you really have to stay vigilant.
Yeah. You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Adrian, to you, you and Ellen teamed up with attorney Michael Cord, who is a well-known radio host and columnist, to request an apology from the city. Why now, or is that something that you had requested from the city before?
Well, I requested an apology from the University of Penn, and after speaking with my supporters, and we decided that it was only fair that the city also apologize, since they had to give permissions for these experiments to take place at the prison.
And I want to talk about Penn in just a moment, but the mayor did say in his statement recently that he hoped that his apology would give families like yours some degree of closure. Did it for you?
I don't know what's going to give us closure. I'm going to speak for myself, because you're talking about decades and decades of downward spirals in my life, you know, and I'm not blaming everything. Life is going to have its turns, but this was like a jump start, you know, for my downward spiral in life emotionally. And I don't know if I will ever have any satisfaction from anyone. I appreciate it. I appreciate the apologies because they're way long overdue. I appreciate it, and so does my family, because not only was my life affected, but it's a generational effect, you know, through my family. So I accept the apology. I'm very appreciative for the apology, but this is the, we can begin, and I'm talking about me and my family, the healing process can start now, because we do feel some level of relief. Well, they do for me, and you know, because they know what I've been through.
Right. And Adrian, you have, as you mentioned, you requested not only the apology from the University of Pennsylvania, which you did receive last year, but you've also called for restitution from Penn. What might that look like?
Well, right now, from Penn, I did request from University of Penn to, you know, let me think about that one, because they did offer some form of reparations, and we're in the process of reviewing that right now. So right now, I don't want to make a statement on that, if that's okay with you.
Got it. Understood. Alan, quickly, because we only have a few minutes, and I have a number of questions for both of you before we have to say goodbye, but in thinking about the apology from Penn last year, it came only after years of defending Dr. Kligman's actions. What do you think took them so long, and what has happened since then in terms of the way that Penn has handled Dr. Kligman's legacy?
Yeah, I think, in my view, Penn has proven itself more wedded to money than anything else, certainly not ethics. They allowed this to go on for nearly a quarter century. They stood by Kligman, defended him, defended their actions. They honored him with various professorships and lectureships. He was even on one of the board of advisors or trustees of their famed bioethics program. He should be the last person on that. They have all of these elite, talented, well-paid academics with all these degrees, certainly in bioethics, but there was not one who ever spoke out about what happened in Philadelphia. And let me tell you, I've studied this issue pretty thoroughly. And yes, it is true that there were experiments on prisoners around the country. You had flash burn studies in Virginia. You had sexually transmitted disease experiments in Indiana. You had testicular irradiation experiments in Oregon and Washington. But they only went on for a few weeks, a few months, maybe a year in one particular area of study. Kligman turned the Philly prison system into a department store of opportunity for investigative researchers. Anybody from anywhere could come to Kligman with a protocol in areas that he had no experience in, such as chemical warfare agents for the U.S. Army. And Kligman would not only entertain it, he would shake hands over it, they would pay him money, and he would do their studies. In fact, he turned the Philly prison system into the Macy's of human research in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And Penn certainly deserves all of the negative criticism that they have received and more. And it's just very troubling to think we have this elite institution in Philadelphia, but they've always felt comfortable making money off of what their scientists and doctors do there, not caring about what they see as the flotsam and jetsam of society who are being used in these experiments.
Yeah. And we should point out as well, Alan, that there have been, you know, Penn has taken some steps, right? They have removed Dr. Kligman's name.
Recently,
right?
They have, with a lot of banging, a lot of negative op-eds, with additional people coming on to support my effort and recognizing themselves that something untoward
happened here. Very appreciative that Adrian came on board. Michael Court has been of great assistance in this campaign. We now look favorably with city council acting on this, and we have some other institutions in mind. So, yes, the train is moving out. Yeah. But Penn in particular was very resistant to owning up to this. And I do appreciate Mayor Kenney and the administration coming forth certainly quicker than I expected.
Adrian, your dad went from being a prisoner to being an activist because of his experience. And you, of course, have picked up that mantle since his death in 2018. And I'm wondering what you think he might make of this moment and these long-awaited apologies.
I'm sure my father is proud and smiling down on the whole situation, especially because his lifespan wasn't long enough to hear the first apology from Penn, let alone the city. But I also want to bring up the fact that my father was also the whistleblower in these experiments when he saw something was wrong. And with that, he and Alan Lawson were invited to Washington to testify in front of the committee when Kennedy was in office about why they thought these experiments were unethical.
Yeah. One last question in our last 30 seconds, Adrian, and that is that we were reminded during the COVID pandemic of the distrust that many in the Black community have toward the medical establishment. In light of your experience, I'm wondering, what do you want medical professionals to know about treating patients of color, understanding where all of the distrust comes from?
Well, I have one statement for that. We have to collaborate on a way where we can begin to build trust between the medical professionals and the Black and brown communities. It has to be done so we can move forward, because medical experimentation is very important. That's how we get our treatments for different medical ailments. We have to have that, but we have to know that we trust the ones who are administering these experiments. Yeah. To be doing the right thing, and ethics play a major role in their professional, lives.
Right, no doubt. Well, thank you so much to Adrian Jones Alston and to Alan Hornblum for joining us to talk about these apologies from the City of Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania. There is much more to come on the Radio Times Regional Roundup.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. We've all been there, and truth be told, many of us are there now, where life feels just a little too hectic, the to-do list is just a little too long, and the days are just a little too short to get it all done and still have time left over for what really matters. In a country that wears busyness like a badge of honor, it's easy to feel like life is a constant race against the clock. But our next guest says it doesn't have to be. Laura Vanderkam is a Philadelphia area time management expert, podcast host, and author of many books. She is also a wife and a mother of five, so she knows a thing or two about busy schedules. Laura's newest book, Tranquility by Tuesday, 9 Ways to Calm the Chaos and Make Time for What Matters, comes out tomorrow, but we've got her in studio today for a preview. Laura Vanderkam, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, congratulations on the book, and tell me what makes this book different from other time management books that you've written.
Yeah, so for Tranquility by Tuesday, I realized a few years ago as I was giving people time management advice, which I've done a lot of times over the years, that I was often telling people the same things. Even though people's lives look incredibly different, I wound up giving much of the same advice. So I decided to hone this down into 9 of my favorite time management rules that I think are broadly applicable and can help people enjoy life more. So not just use our time well, but also feel like we're having a good time while we're doing it. Yeah. And in order to make sure that these rules actually worked, I recruited 150 busy people to try them out for 9 weeks. So each week they would learn a rule, ask questions, answer questions for me about how they plan to use the rule in their lives, answered questions a week later about how it went. I measured them on various dimensions over the course of the 9 weeks to see, do the rules really work? And I'm happy to report that they do. The people who followed these rules saw their levels of time satisfaction rise to a high degree of statistical significance.
So this is more than just good ideas. This is scientifically proven methodologies for people to not only manage their time better, but enjoy their life in the process.
Exactly. I mean, I write self-help for busy people. So if I'm going to suggest something, I want to make sure that it works. And so my team put these people through a very rigorous process. We measured them on all sorts of dimensions. And, you know, they answered things quantitatively, but also qualitatively. I mean, much of the book is their answers, describing how these various time management practices made a huge difference in their lives.
I'm interested in the fact that rather than suggesting that your readers find ways to eliminate things from their schedule, you're actually asking us to add some things like big and small adventures to our week. And it feels a bit counterintuitive on its face to be adding things to an already full schedule. How does that work?
Yes, I know it does sound a wee bit counterintuitive because our automatic idea is if life seems crazy and busy and overwhelming, is we need to take things off our plate. And I'm not saying there aren't some things that should probably go in most of our lives. But often when people feel tired and overwhelmed and exhausted, it's not so much that we are exhausted, it's that we need change. Like we're doing so many things that we have to do. We haven't asked ourselves what we want to do. And when we start putting things into our lives that we are genuinely looking forward to, that we truly want to do, that make life feel interesting and enjoyable, we find that we have a lot more energy. And, you know, we do the things we have to do, right? We meet our deadlines, we get our families where they need to go. I'm asking people to think about what would make life feel fun and challenging people to add a few of these things into their lives. You know, just experiment. But I'm pretty sure that you will start to feel like life is a lot more doable.
It's like you're giving us permission to do the things that we'd like to do, but we feel like we don't have the time for, or almost feel like that's taking away time from something we should be doing.
If there's anything I've found over the years, it's that time is highly elastic. And once we put things into our lives that we wish to be doing, it's funny how everything else sort of shrinks a little bit to allow for that. We naturally spend a wee bit less time on email. We spend a little bit less time puttering around the house, maybe a little bit less time on social media and things like that when we have things that we are genuinely looking forward to.
Yeah. So there are 9 rules or guidelines for those who are not enthralled with the idea of rules. But one of them is effortful before effortless. What does that mean?
So this rule is about how we spend our leisure time. And I have found that even the busiest people have some amount of leisure time. The problem is that it often comes in unexpected chunks, or it is short in duration, or it comes when we have very little energy. So at night after the kids go to bed, or after we've done our chores or gotten off work or something like that. And screen time tends to fill these chunks of time just incredibly well. It doesn't make demands on us. You can be on Twitter for 2 minutes or 20 minutes. It doesn't really matter, right? And so we wind up spending more of our leisure time on those forms of effortless fun, screen time of various sorts, than we might actually choose if we thought about it. Because many people are like, well, I'd love to have time for reading. I'd love to have time for hobbies. I'd love to have time to connect with friends. If only I had the time. But what we need to do is figure out how we can use some of these chunks of time for leisure that would feel more rejuvenating. So to do effortful before effortless means do just a few minutes of effortful fun before you switch to the effortless variety. So read an ebook for 2 minutes before you switch over to Instagram, or do a puzzle for 10 minutes before you turn on Netflix at night. And one of two things will happen. Sometimes people get so excited about their effortful fun that they just keep going. They want to find out what happens in that mystery novel and they never wind up over at Facebook, and that's probably fine. or you know, even if you do wind up switching, even if you go over to Netflix after 10 minutes on your puzzle, you are still now the kind of person who has both kinds of fun. You have changed the balance of your leisure time, and that makes it just feel more rejuvenating. I mean, when people in my study did this, they had, you know, I asked them various times how much they agreed with different statements. And the particular statement of yesterday, I didn't waste time on things that weren't important to me, their scores on that question rose 32% after they started putting this rule into effect.
Wow. So there are, as we mentioned, there are 9 rules. Some of them do require a bit of discipline. It's not all just about adding fun to your life, like, you know, giving yourself a bedtime was one of them. And another one was planning on Fridays. Why Friday? And what might a planning session look like?
Yeah, so this rule to plan on Fridays really encompasses 2 things. The first and most important is to plan. I think everybody needs a designated weekly planning time where you look forward to the next week and you ask yourself not just what's happening, but what is important. What is important in 3 spheres of life: career, relationships, self. Make sure you've got something in all 3 categories. Figure out where those priorities can go. Look at what is already on your schedule. Figure out if you need to solve any logistical problems. Make sure you've got something you can look forward to. But by looking at the week as a whole, we can just make wiser choices about how we allocate our time. But as for Friday, this is maybe a little bit surprising to people why I'm so specific about this. But I think, you know, for starters, if you have a Monday through Friday sort of job, Friday afternoon is what an economist might call a low opportunity cost time. Most of us are not, you know, saying on Friday afternoons, I am excited to make progress on my personal and professional priorities right now. We are sliding into the weekend, very hard to start anything new. But you might be willing to think about what future you should be doing. And if you take a few minutes to plan on Friday afternoon, you can turn what might be wasted time into some very productive time. But, you know, even more important than that, even people who really like their jobs, if they haven't planned the upcoming week on Friday, if they'd left it until Sunday or Monday, Sunday afternoon, you know, you start feeling a little bit of trepidation, like, oh, I know I have all this stuff waiting for me. I don't know how I'm going to deal with it. And it can keep you from enjoying what is left of your weekend.
It's the Sunday scaries.
It's the Sunday scaries. But if you end work on Friday with a plan for Monday morning, you can relax.
Yeah, you can enjoy your Sunday
enjoy
a little
yourself.
Bit better.
Yeah.
Laura, you've got a husband, you've got 5 kids, you host 2 podcasts, you write books, you blog, you do public speaking. Are there times when even you, as a productivity expert, feel overwhelmed with all of that? And I'm wondering, what is your biggest time management challenge?
Oh, everything is a work in progress for me. I mean, I wrote this book for myself as much for anyone. And over at my website, I've been posting what I call Tranquility by Tuesday scorecards, where I rate myself every week on whether I follow the 9 rules or not. Some weeks are definitely better than others. You know, every night I have some little gremlin in my head that's telling me, no, you don't have to go to bed. You know you're supposed to have a bedtime, but you don't have to go to bed. You can stay up.
Because you're a grown-up.
I'm a grown-up. You don't have to go to bed. Stay up all night if you want. But, you know, I try to tell myself that future Laura will be much happier with me in the morning if I do go to bed. That's a constant challenge. I mean, as is things like the effortful before effortless. Like all of us, I probably spend a little bit too much time on screens. I'm trying to make it better. But, you know, progress over perfection.
Yeah. There was something that you wrote about in your book that really struck me, and it was that you said you've been tracking your life in 30-minute increments since 2015, which sounds a little intense. I'm wondering what made you decide to do that and what you've learned about yourself in all that tracking through the years.
Really makes me sound like a lot of fun, doesn't it? I have been tracking my time in 30-minute increments since 2015. In 2015, you know, I've had thousands of people track their time for me for a week over the years because I find it is truly the best way to figure out what life really looks like. A week is the cycle of life as we actually live it. Many of us have no idea where the time truly goes. We don't even know that there are 168 hours in a week. So that right there is an eye-opener for people to figure out how they're allocating their hours. So when I'm working with people, I always have them track their time for a week. At some point in my life, I figured, well, fair is fair. I need to do it myself, and let me see if I can keep going. So I'm not just choosing one week, which might be the week I wish to show the world, you know, the week when I'm following all 9 rules, as it were. This is just, you know, if I keep going, I'll have to see what all my time looks like. And I went for a year because I figured I could write about it, and I did for various places. But I learned so much, and it was so easy to do after a while, that I just kept going. I mean, honestly, it's just a habit at this point. I check in roughly 3 times a day. Each time, you know, the check-in is 1 minute. I write down what I've done since the last check-in. Broad strokes, I'll just write work, hang out with kids, sleep, you know, watch TV, whatever it is. So check in 3 times a day, 1 minute each time, 3 minutes. It's the same amount of time I spend brushing my teeth each day, which, you know, is a habit I've managed to stick with as well for the past 7 years.
Also a good habit
to have. Also a good habit to have.
I'm wondering, too, Laura, about this phenomenon that we've been hearing about, particularly this year, this idea of quiet quitting, right, where people are just sort of dialing back on their work responsibilities. There's been a sense of burnout in some quarters. And I'm wondering, as someone who is a productivity expert, what your thoughts are about that phenomenon.
Well, sometimes I think what people are drawn to with the phrase quiet quitting is that it's a bit ambiguous. And so there's the part where people are like, oh, well, they're, you know, doing the bare minimum and shoving their work on their colleagues, and no one likes that idea. There's also the idea of setting better boundaries about, you know, what you will and don't do at work. And so I think, you know, part of the ambiguity is what, you know, is drawing people to the phrase. But if people are feeling tired, if they are feeling overwhelmed, both at work and at home, as we talked about earlier, often there is the sense that something has to go. And maybe there are things that have to go. If you track your time, you might see things that are taking more time than you imagined, in which case, you know, let's work to solve that problem. But I also find that it's often an energy question. And when life feels like a series of have-to-dos, when it's just one never-ending to-do list, well, that's no fun. Like, there's nothing to enjoy in that. And of course, our energy levels are going to drag. We draw energy from meaningful things. So put things into your life that are meaningful, that are enjoyable, that you are looking forward to, and your energy levels will rise. In the course of the Tranquility by Tuesday study, people's agreement scores with the statements of "I have enough energy to handle my responsibilities" rose dramatically. I mean, over the course of the 9 weeks, they felt like they were making progress on their professional goals, even though they were putting things mostly into their personal lives. They felt like they were making progress on their personal lives as well, too. So I think, you know, it can be about adding things as well as taking things away.
In terms of thinking about what brings you joy, the things that you might want to add to your life that add joy, that just make life feel more enjoyable, no doubt there are some readers who might find it challenging to even identify what they enjoy, because certainly up until COVID and even through it, so many of us have been working so hard for so long, we've kind of lost sight of that. So I wonder what advice you would have for somebody who isn't even sure what would bring them joy. How would they identify that?
I think we need to start being serious about our joy. Like, actually put some thought into it in the same way that you would put thought into, how do I pitch something to a new client? How do I get this promotion at work? Let's really take the question of how can I enjoy my life more seriously. You know, I would say that leisure time is too precious to be totally leisurely about leisure. So make yourself lists. You know, make a really long list of anything you might want to spend more time doing. There's no reason to edit yourself. There's no reason to ask, you know, is that an okay thing to put down? If you want to go sing karaoke, that is totally fine. Nobody is judging you. Just anything you want to put on this list. And then just start experimenting. One of my rules is to have one big adventure and one little adventure each week. And many of these things that you want to spend more time doing could become adventures. You know, and a rate of 2 adventures a week is probably not going to exhaust or bankrupt anyone. But this is the week you could try going mini golfing and try singing karaoke. Or this is the week you try that new gelato place and, you know, go take a hike somewhere, maybe even on a long lunch break, crazy enough as that might sound. You know, but just try it out, right? Just try it out. And I'm pretty sure, you know, it could always be different, but I'm pretty sure you will start feeling better.
Yeah. Lots of ways to try fun things, and you never know what you might stumble on in the process. The book is called Tranquility by Tuesday, 9 Ways to Calm the Chaos and Make Time for What Matters. The author is Laura Vanderkam. She is a blogger, an author, a podcast host, a wife, a mom of 5. She is very, very busy, but she has figured out some ways to get it all done and enjoy her life, and she wants us to do the same. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our producer today was Paige Murray. Best Kessler, and our engineer has been Diana Martinez. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan, and you are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY.